financial advisor at 715-421-0958.
Now, let's get back to exciting Raptors baseball here on WFHR.
Raptors postgame show coming your way here on WFHR, and not able to get the comeback going as the Raptors trailed by 9 at one point in the game. They had the tying runner at the plate at the end of it, but not able to drive in the run. So the final score was 9-6. Let's take a look back at how it all happened. And first inning really went the Rockers' way. The Raptors went 3 up, 3 down, although they did have a leadoff single. Kobayashi was caught stealing. Bottom of the first, it was a one-out solo shot from Colin Helms that put them up 1-0, and then the Rockers added two more on the single from Max Humphrey and added one more on the RBI single from Braden Buchanan. That made it 4-0, and then in the second inning, the Raptors once again scoreless, although they had yet another single, but bottom of the second, it was a solo shot from Eli Selga off of Tyler Pacetti. Third inning comes around. Raptors get a leadoff single, but they leave him on second. River Lindsay not able to come around after his first hit as a Raptor. And in the bottom of the third, another two runs came across for the Rockers, and that's when they really took the lead. David Bionia, a two-run homer off of Tyler Pacetti, and that made it 7-0 Green Bay in the bottom of the third. In the fourth inning, once again, the Raptors had a hit, but not able to bring him around. They left him on first, Mananaco single. And then in the bottom of the fourth, another two-run shot. Easton Zemplet came into the game. He allowed a double, a line-out, and then the two-run homer from Eli Selga, his second homer of the game. And Selga just had himself a night. But the Rockers up 9-0. And then Zemplet was able to start getting things to go his direction. Recorded a couple outs to finish the fourth, and then a scoreless fifth inning for both teams, although the Raptors went 3 up, 3 down. They held the Rockers scoreless, and in the sixth inning, neither team scored again. A perfect inning from Easton Zemple before he came out of the game after 46 pitches. Seventh inning comes around, and in the top of the seventh, that is when the Raptors finally started to score. They scored 3 runs in the inning, an RBI double from Lachlan Bond, and a 2-RBI double from Hiroto Kobayashi. That made it 9-3. And then in the bottom of the seventh, it was a 3 up, 3 down inning from Jackson Phillip, who made his Raptors debut as well. He only threw 8 pitches and recorded those 3 outs, although he allowed the 1 hit. That was it. And then in the bottom of the eighth, the top of the eighth, the Raptors once again got the offense moving. They scored 3 runs in the top of the eighth inning, 3 straight hits to get things rolling along, and it included the RBI single from Mananaco that drove home Jake Beauchesne. And then it was an RBI ground out from Peyton Bryant and an RBI ground out from Lachlan Maud that made it a 9-6 game. Then in the ninth inning, the Raptors had a chance. They had a leadoff walk from Mike Monahan, a two-out walk from Jake Beauchesne, put runners on to second and third after a couple of defensive indifferences. But Mananaco struck out swinging with 2 outs. He was the runner representing the tying run, wasn't able to get on base, and that ended the game. Final score was 9-6. Let's take a look back at the numbers for tonight. And first off, with the offense on the Raptors' side, Hiroto Kobayashi, a multi-hit game. He went 2-for-5 with 2 RBIs in the double. Along with that, Mananaco 2-for-5 with an RBI, 2-for-4 for Landon Gaz. And behind that, River Lindsay in his Raptors debut, 2-for-4 with a run scored and 2 stolen bases. On the pitching side, Tyler Pacetti really struggled over his 3 innings, 7 runs allowed, although only 4 of them were earned on 6 hits and 2 walks. Easton Zemple, another pretty strong performance outside of his first couple of batters, and he went 3 complete innings, allowed 2 runs. Both were earned on 3 hits, no walks, and had 1 strikeout. Jackson Phillip had a 3 up, 3 down inning, and then Jack Wiesinger did as well, both in just 1 inning pitched to finish up the game. That's a look at the stats. Now taking a look ahead to next game for the Raptors. They return to Capital Credit Union Park here in Green Bay as the Raptors will take on the Rockers for one more time this season. The righty Tristan Krusenberry coming out of the hill for the Raptors, taking on the righty KJ Ward for his first time against the Raptors. So looking forward to this game as the Raptors will hope to end it on a strong note. But that is all for tonight's broadcast. So a big shout out as always to the great people of WFHR for hosting us on the radio today and for every game. And along with that, a shout out to the Rafters coaching staff, as they are always great and open to talk about anything that I might need. Another shout out has to be given to, of course, the great people of Green Bay for hosting us and being hospitable as always. Joey Bonadonna, big shout out to him for helping me get set up here, the opposing broadcaster for the Green Bay Rockers. But that's about all from tonight from Capital Credit Union Park. So one final time, the final score of tonight's game, the Rafters 6, the Rockers 9. For myself, Austin Thomas, and from the rest of the Wisconsin Rapids Rafters, thank you and have a great rest of your night.
Problem with, and interestingly enough, trying to destroy. Understand that what Trump did wasn't just a tantrum over how bad those numbers were. This was an assault on the very idea that, you know, facts matter, or even better yet, that there are even facts for that matter. And everyone who relies on those facts. So this is what happened. July's BLS employment report showed that the economy only added 73,000 jobs, well below forecast. The prior months had been revised down by over 250,000 jobs. So Trump's response, obviously, classic authoritarian move. Blame the numbers as phony. Blame Biden. Because, again, remember what he said. Everything bad, Biden. Everything good, Trump. So, you know, clearly this is a Biden appointee. So the numbers had to be phony, right? And he went on his social media, said, she's bad and that she has to be replaced immediately with someone more competent. And by competent, he means a loyal sycophant who can name their favorite Trump executive order. Now, you know, to her rescue came, you know, a number of top economists, former BLS officials, both Republican and Democratic, and they were unified. There's no evidence whatsoever of bias, and that these knee-jerk firings threaten the integrity and credibility of that agency and federal statistics as a whole. And again, this is ripped right out of Orwell's 1984, where truth is whatever dear leader says it is. And facts are rewritten whenever. You know, when they get in the way of the party or Trump's narrative, we got to go back and rewrite yesterday. And I'm sure whoever comes in will go back and revise the 73,000, the 273,000, or 373,000. It was a million jobs Trump created. Might as well be, because don't buy it anyway. And that's why this firing is chilling. Because the BLS's job is to count jobs. Do it accurately, no matter who's on the winning or losing side of it politically. When you fire the commissioner for reporting the truth, you aren't just trashing that one person. You're sending a message across the entire workforce, every worker in that agency. You count the jobs right, or you're next. And by right, to make me look good. Not factual, but just to make me look good. And think about what that means for working people. Anyone who's ever, you know, filed for unemployment or bargained for a union contract, worried about layoffs or inflation, these things depend on an honest, reliable statistics, not I want competent, accurate, real numbers. You know, the ones I like. And when the numbers are fake, the truth of your lived experience understandably gets erased. If Trump, seriously, if he can simply declare real problems, fake news, or rigged data, suddenly nothing is trustworthy. And what this does is it does prove the Republican talking point of government can't or shouldn't do anything. This is the Republican wet dream. But understand, the message here for civil servants is pretty clear. You know, get on board, toe the line, or you're next. Because, of course, this is what authoritarians do. They always go after the scorekeepers. If people can't trust the numbers, if the only truth is what dear leader says, then all the power belongs where? To dear leader. Bad news simply goes away. We failures become victories. I mean, that's true Orwellian speak. And this is a failure. Reality is whatever keeps those in charge feeling better. And this is exactly why workers need union. This is why this person needs a contract. In a system where truth tellers risk being silenced, or in this case, fired, collective action is often all that stands between everyday folks and unchecked power. Because understand, unions give workers a voice, give workers protection, the ability to demand transparency and accountability, not just in their contracts, but in this case, how the country's run. This is why Trump is destroying the civil service and making patronage great again. Understand, when government purges the honest scorekeeper and we're left with sycophants, we better figure out how to come together. We better figure out how to organize. And we better figure out how to say, no, you don't get to rewrite reality. You don't get to punish the truth tellers. We want accountability. And understand, for working people, Trump attacking the BLS, and by extension, the basic idea of truth in government, just one more reason we need to be standing together. Because without independent facts, what are we left with? Other than Trumpian propaganda, other than MAGA propaganda. Without unions, what are we left with? No shield, no protection, no honest broker of reality. Nobody shouting, hey, the emperor's got no clothes, when he abuses power like this. When you fire the scorekeeper, also kind of means you got something to hide. When you call honest numbers lies, it means you don't care about reality or about any of us. So the reality is, this should be one of those things that makes people go too far, bridge too far. Do you think it will? No. The initial response from my red hats, she deserved it. Had it coming. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Is this what can we expect more of this, or are we going to give Trump a break? Want to hear your thoughts? rick@therickSmithShow.com. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So recently, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled 3-0 that for the first time, one of the first times, I guess, that exemption number 4 of the FOIA Act, the Freedom of Information Act, is narrow, and that the federal government has to release diversity data about contractors and the employees that they hire, and that information should be available for journalists and the general public to review and analyze. The case also highlights how contractors cannot get billions of dollars in tax dollars and disregard accountability. And here to share some thoughts on, is this a big deal, and maybe how it is used? That's why I've asked Victoria Baranetsky to come share some thoughts. She's the general counsel at the Center for Investigative Reporting. They're the folks who've been fighting this for almost the last decade. Victoria, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, Rick. Good to be here.
So walk me through, why is this a big deal? You know, most people have no idea, you know, about FOIA requests or information or any of this. Why is this important?
Yeah. So there are a lot of reasons why this is important. But I think one of the main places to start is the records themselves. So this case is about these reports that the Department of Labor creates and administers and collects from federal contractors. And federal contractors that have 50 or more employees are essentially required to fill out these records. And they disclose, on total, the diversity statistics of their workforce. So they talk about, you know, how many women there are, how many African Americans there are, and they break it down by race and gender. And they're one-page document that disclose these very high-level narratives and also break it down by work category. And the government has been collecting these for a long time. Like I said, they're required under Title VII. And reporters like to have access to that information to know whether those contractors are complying with federal law or not. And they tell about the demographics of the workforce. And for many years, various members of Congress, congressional commissions, policy advocates, investor groups have all advocated for these records to be public. It's thought to be seen as a pretty positive thing for society. And in fact, about 10 years ago, there was even a movement within industry to make these records public. So Intel kind of started it by publishing diversity reports on their own websites. I think a lot of people are probably familiar with the idea that companies sometimes publish their demographics on their website. And that really is part of this conversation with these diversity reports. And this is the case, in this case, it's really the first time in a while that a court has stated that these records should be public. There was actually a case, you know, over 20 years ago that found the same thing, but time had passed and there was a question about whether they could be disclosed again. And we've actually had to file this case three times, and I can tell you more about that story.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you about this because, you know, as I understand, this happened during the Obama years, right? Or was this during the Trump years when this started?
So we filed this case three times. There was a decision that was yielded in 2018. We settled with the government. They disclosed the records. In 2019, a district court said that we could have these records and they were disclosed. And so this case happened after that second one. We asked for a third time to the government, you know, can we please get access to these records? And the Supreme Court had recently issued a decision that complicated it. And so the government said, no, these are confidential business information. And that's really, I think, when things got off to the races, because there were two reporters in our newsroom, Will Evans and Sanduja, and they both came into my office and they said, you know, we want to have access to these records. Companies publish them. Everybody thinks they should be disclosed. And believe it or not, the government is claiming that these are confidential business information. And I just couldn't believe that answer because I didn't really understand how the government or a company would qualify this to be confidential information when it's, you know, talked about on Glassdoor, when right. companies publish this information, when it's often visible to the naked eye. You know, so we went to court to litigate whether that was true or not under the law.
So let me ask you this, you know, why is it that a group like the Center for Investigative Reporting, whom I understand is, you know, basically Mother Jones and this Reveal News, you know, outlets that a lot of folks know, but they're not at the top of the information chain like the New York Times or the Washington Post or those folks who should have been fighting this. Shouldn't this be one of those things that shouldn't have had to be done by you guys?
Well, I don't know who should have or shouldn't have had to do it, but I do know that our reporters, you know, wanted to tell this story. They had been telling various, you know, news reporting about demographics, particularly of Silicon Valley companies that are increasingly getting federal government contracts, as we know, as has been in the press. You know, Palantir recently just got a huge contract from DOD of several hundred million of millions of dollars. And so there is an interest from our newsroom about accountability about these actors, particularly as they're taking up more and more work from the government and collecting tons of data about us in our daily lives, which, you know, often they assert is confidential business information.
Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, we're watching the Trump administration basically hand over all of our information, all of our data to Doge Boy and his ferrets. We're seeing all of this happening while simultaneously they're destroying the arms of our government, NIOSH, you know, things at the Department of Labor. They're destroying data collection. So in looking at this, is this one of those potential wins that they're just going to stop collecting this kind of data and we're not going to find out anyway? Or is this ruling going to go, no, you've got to collect this data?
I don't know if this is a win in terms of information that the government is deleting. You know, this is a win for access to information that exists for sure. You're right, right? The Trump administration, there's been deletion of data from, you know, the Smithsonian, from census data, information about the environment. And there's even discussions that, you know, OCCP, the agency in the Department of Labor that we sued about this, has really been diminished in size. So question whether they can, you know, continue collecting all this data. But what I will say is that I think it is a win in two ways. So one, I think it shows the government that there are actors out there who still want to fight for information that exists and that they will go to court one, two, and even three times to get access to it. And I think it's another win, which is that it created an important precedent. So this case essentially makes it harder for a government contractor to claim that information is confidential business information. Not only does a company have to show that it's confidential, meaning that it's actually or customarily secret, but they have to prove in the first instance that the records are commercial in the first place. And here, the Ninth Circuit said these records, these diversity reports, are not commercial records in the first instance. And it, if, you know, the rule that they said was they either have to be, you know, commercial themselves, meaning the data is actually valuable, so they sell it, or it has to go to commercial aspects of the business. So it's like sales statistics, marketing information, things that are intimate to the business and the bottom line. And so now companies and the government have to meet that test. They have to show, does this information really reach that level of relationship to the commercial aspect of the business? Or is this a blanket cover that they're using for secrecy?
So let me get this straight, because, you know, this is government data being collected that we should have access to. This isn't private corporate data.
That's right. And I guess what I'm saying, so in this case, these are records that the contractor files with the government to show compliance.
Right.
That's what these reports
Because are. In a lot of our contracts, there are things in there that we've put in there to try and increase diversity, try to get, you know, more minorities, more women, more folks, jobs or contracts. So we probably should be tracking that somehow, no?
Well, I think what this decision does is essentially, if you think about all the data that the government creates, and when a federal contractor is in charge of that data, they might claim, hey, this is our data. This is confidential business information. And now, in order to claim that, when a contractor is working on behalf of the public to engage in a contract for surveillance, to do roads, to do infrastructure, to, you know, help with healthcare or whatever it might be, that information generally, if it was just the government doing it, we'd have access under FOIA.
Okay.
And
I just wanted to make that distinction, because this is one of those things that, you know, the next question being is, you know, is there a way to start looking at this kind of information for you know, gig workers and, you know, people that we're trying to rule as independent contractors, or, you know, private companies that maybe don't have a government contract. Is this a way to potentially do some of that, or is this just narrowly decided?
Yeah, so this is really just a decision that impacts information that's in the government's hands that in some way had interaction with a federal contractor and or somehow had a relationship to a business, and that business in any way could claim, or a federal, or, you know, a contractor or a private entity somehow claims that it's confidential business information.
So the other question I've got is, you know, this information, you know, given the fact that you've got an administration hostile to diversity, inclusion, and equity, and ran an entire campaign on this, is this, you know, something that, and I think I've already asked a version of this, but is this some way of you know, shining light on some of the inequities that are going on, or is this just purely about journalists getting information?
Well, listen, I think it's a little bit of both. So, you know, the records at issue here, they dated to the years 2016 through 2020. And so, you know, the first batch of that's going to be pretty old. It's going to be almost 10 years old, 2020, a little bit less so. But it certainly gives a snapshot of where these companies were in that point in time. So I'll just give you a little taste of what it might show. You know, in our 2017 case, when we filed for these records before, Palantir asserted in a letter to the Department of Labor that disclosing these records was confidential business information because it would give away a competitive disadvantage, because it would allow others to, their competitors, to steal talent. And, you know, it was interesting because when Palantir had to ultimately release its data, it showed that it didn't have any female executives and just one woman in its manager group. And that was despite Palantir claiming that it had made, quote, significant progress in hiring women and minorities.
Well,
so
there's one.
There is one.
So the question then becomes, does transparency about their demographics, does it actually prevent discrimination? Does it actually give people opportunities? Is this something that we should be wanting?
Yeah, I mean, I think the question about transparency and whether it works is really interesting. I think that various studies over time have shown different things. Sometimes transparency actually has the opposite effect. But I think in a case like this one, it's been rather uniformly decided that disclosure of what they're reporting to the government is important. Because whether or not it's a fully accurate picture, I mean, first of all, it's literally just the basic numbers of the company. It's the black and white truth of what they're representing about their own employees. And regardless, it's the story they're telling to the government. And that's what's important, right? These are documents that are accounting what a company is telling the United States government that's paying federal tax dollars for their work. And so, as members of the public, we have a right to see that information.
Right. So last question I've got for you, you know, in looking at, you know, workers groups, unions, activists, is this information, will this be helpful in fighting for better wages, hours, conditions, making work lives better? Do you see this as something that, outside of something very narrow for journalists and, you know, very, kind of esoteric, I guess, do you see this giving aid in other places?
Yeah, I think that this decision, with regards to diversity, I think, you know, the various people who are a lot more expert than me know better, right? 30 years ago, there was this thing called the Federal Glass Ceiling Commission, created by the Civil Rights Act of 1991, and they created this report, and it said that they urged the federal government to increase public access to diversity data, and that it was an important thing for the public's knowledge. So I think there's been a lot of experts with a lot more knowledge about this information who would say that posting this kind of data helps in a variety of ways with our society. But I think there's also this second aspect, which is, in general, this case shows that that the government has to reach a certain bar in order to claim secrecy. And that's really what is important, I think, with this case, is that The government can't simply give a rubber stamp with a corporation on its side and say, we're holding this back. This is trade secret, or this is confidential business information. They have to do a bit more.
Yeah, in this day and age, that alone is a huge victory. Victoria, I appreciate you taking some time for us, sharing this. And I'd love to talk to you again and see how this plays out down the road, especially what the administration's response is going to be.
We will see. I'm happy to talk to you at that later date.
I appreciate it. Victoria Baranetsky, General Counsel there at the Center for Investigative Reporting. You can check out their work at revealnews.org. Or I also believe CIR.org. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at that. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. This is a big deal. Do you see it? Could this be helpful? I want to hear your thoughts. Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Right back.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR. As Wisconsin as a fish fry on a Friday night, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Partly cloudy tonight, slight shower chance, lows upper 50s to 60. And hazy sunshine for tomorrow, clouds mixed at times, high in the low 80s. Chance of showers and storms Wednesday. Warms up a little more and more humid. Highs in the mid-80s. Currently at 68.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I got friends who live in Texas who tell me, you don't mess with Texas. And the other one, everything's bigger. Everything's bigger in Texas. Or so I'm told. And my response is, I guess nobody makes company towns great again like Texas. Big gerrymandering and a big push towards poverty wages and deadly working conditions. Is that good? Is that something we want Texas to do? And if they do it there, do we want to export it across the country? That to me is the question. Here to share some thoughts on, well, if we should be messing with Texas, I've asked my good friend Rick Levy to come talk with us. Rick's the president of the Texas AFL-CIO. You can check out their website, texasaflcio.org. Rick, thanks for taking time for us.
It is great to be with you, Rick. I just being back on your show, I'm reminded of all the minds and lives you've touched over your career with this show, and it's an honor to be here with you.
I appreciate it. So, look, let's start with the everything's bigger in Texas. Company town. Yeah, you got Elon Musk started a company town down there. And I look at the Genius Act, which is going to bring crypto, this push towards digital. It appears to me we're recreating the bad old days of company towns and company script.
Yeah, we're turning over the keys to the kingdom to some pretty unsavory characters. This last legislative session, we allowed Elon Musk to create his own little city down called Starbase X or something like that, where they launch their rockets. And, you know, when you first think about it, so what? But the thing about it that's so devastating is it gives this, where this piece of land is, it gives them total authority to open and close the beaches whenever he's doing a launch. So public beaches are now subject to the whim of Elon Musk, not to mention all the debris that is showered over the whole area when he launches these failing rockets. So, yeah, it's a really good metaphor for some much broader things that are happening in Texas, where we're kind of giving up so much control over our lives to these folks that do not have our best interests at heart.
No, and that's the reason I started there, because look, you know, we're continuing to change our government and to give control of our government to people like Musk, to the billionaire class. And the last time that happened, for those of us who kind of look at history, occasionally, it didn't work out very well for working people.
Yeah. And that's what's so dangerous about what's going on right now, is that the brazenness of this seizure of the means of governance is unprecedented and unbelievable to me. Whether it's the biggest transfer of wealth from working class people to billionaires in the history of the world with this recently passed ugly ass bill, is what I call it. Whether it's like literally taking money from working families to give subsidies to rich people to send their kids to private schools. Whether it's, you know, Texas, we're already at the very bottom in terms of number of people that have access to health insurance. Kicking hundreds of thousands of people more off of healthcare simply to fund these billionaire tax cuts, which, oh, by the way, explode the deficit that we'll be paying for from our taxes for decades and if not longer to go. So it's not heading in the right direction, Rick. And I'm not trying to cheer you up. I'm just trying to like talk about what it is. And you know, unless we wake up and really get serious about challenging some of this stuff, it's only going to get worse.
And this is why what the work that you guys do at the Texas AFL-CIO and unions across this country do is so important. And it's the last line of democracy. What we are witnessing right before our very eyes is a push towards authoritarianism on steroids and a corporatocracy that I fear once complete, we don't get away from.
So much happens that every day that I go, really? Whether it's, you know, intimidating universities, which are supposed to be the bastions of free thought, into giving him control over their curriculum. Whether it's companies that have like gone running from any kind of semblance of pursuing justice in the workplace, not to mention just the whole scale terror that's being waged by these vigilantes that call themselves ICE that are devastating communities across the country. It's just, it is so much like what I know happened in the late 1920s and 1930s in Germany in terms of eliminating any institution that has the ability to challenge. That's why we've seen him go so hard after federal workers. They have the ability to challenge. And that what you said at the very beginning of what you just said, which is that unions are the only thing that truly can stand up and say no to this, because we have our own independent institutional basis. We know how to fight, and we better start doing it.
No, absolutely. And, you know, you brought up the ICE raids and the things that are going on. And, you know, Texas is like ground zero to where a lot of this stuff is happening. Yeah. So for people who they're not seeing it on the evening news, they're not seeing it in their backyards. What's going on? How bad is what they're doing?
It is vile and terroristic what they're doing. And like just this week, Congressman Greg Kassar, who's been an incredible voice on all of this stuff, in terms of punching back at what's happening, was like other people in other parts of the country, accompanying immigrants to their hearings in federal immigration court, and seeing people literally snatched out of courtrooms by masked people and put on vans and buses to who knows where, and then not able to even find out. I mean, this is the United States of America, and this is what's happening in broad daylight, and it's happening in communities all over this state and all over the country.
Now, some would say, well, they're criminals. They're here illegally. I've got my red hats who are saying, you know, they're here illegally. They got to go. This is what they voted for. Now, interestingly enough, you've got the Rogans and some of the other right-wing mouthpieces going, whoa, 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 I thought we were just going after the bad guys. I didn't know we were going after the people who were going to cut my grass and clean my hotel room. Yeah. Any thoughts?
My thoughts are that when you start labeling people criminals without giving anybody due process about whether they're a criminal or not, whether they're here illegally or not, that due process under our Constitution applies to every person in this country. And who decides whether somebody's a criminal? Is it just because Donald Trump sees a tattoo he doesn't understand and all of a sudden he's a criminal? And it's, you know, it's people like Steve Miller that are putting quotas on getting rid of thousands of people a day. There are the niceties of who's a criminal and who's not a criminal don't exist anymore. This is an all-out attack on immigrant communities. It's racially motivated. I mean, the fact that, you know, just there's so much that puts the lie to this, but the fact that we're granting special rights to white South African immigrants who are, you know, because of the persecution that they feel is going on in their country, given the history of that country, and we're throwing Haitians and Venezuelans and Dominicans and people out of this country with no reason. It's just, it puts the lie to it. This is a racial and ethnic cleansing, using ICE as the force to do it.
And I would also argue, you know, since I'm talking to a labor leader, I got to question the labor implications of this. Because, you know, these are folks who are starting to start demanding some better wages, some better conditions. These are folks who would be people who would want to fight for better wages, hours, conditions. It seems to me that this is, you would know better than I, a massive chilling effect across all those industries, as now we're pushing people back underground where they are most desperate and most exploitable.
And it is the contrast. Under the last administration, we had rules in place that said if you're involved in an organizing campaign, you can get deferred action with respect to your immigration status, because we didn't want companies to be able to use somebody's immigration status to lower conditions for everybody. And we wanted everybody to make sure that if you're working for a living, you have the same rights as everybody else, regardless of your legal status.
Now you said for everybody. So I want to pick on that for a second. You said lowering working conditions for everybody, not just the quote unquote illegals, not just for the undocumented, but for everybody, right?
100%. Because what is our biggest impediment to achieving a fair contract with our companies? It's not having everybody on board. It's having a group of folks that are easily exploited to pit against other people. And once you eliminate that basis for that kind of discrimination and that kind of marginalization, working class people can be united in their fight against the boss. And we were involved in so many of those things here in Texas, where you had hotel workers that were literally organizing and the company was starting to threaten them about their immigration status if they organize, which affects the people who have documentation, the people who don't. And the company was using that to bust the union. But because we had this deferred action, the immigrant workers could speak up with full authority and the workers could stay united, and they won their union, and that improved life for everybody. Yeah. And the shame of that now is that the government is using that data of people who had that deferred action to specifically target those folks for deportation, because they had the nerve to stand up for themselves and for others in their workplace.
And again, that sends a chilling effect across organizing campaigns going forward as well, right?
For decades going forward. That's right.
Now, you know, I look at this, and again, you know, there are people, this is what they voted for. And while the Rogans and some are saying, this isn't what we voted for, the reality is it's been my experience that this is what most of the Republicans voted for. How do Democrats use this to get people to come around to the reality that Trump and his ilk, well, if they're going to come for those folks, eventually they're going to come for you. And by doing away with due process, you got problems too.
I mean, it's I've had conversations with folks who are like, well, you know, the federal unions, you know, those folks don't really work as hard as I do, or, you know, what is this about, you know, remote work? I go to work every day, and I get that. But the bottom line is, if you think that these folks are going to stop at federal unions and say, okay, that's good, now I'll let all the other unions thrive. Hell, look at the NLRB, look at the Department of Labor, look at the consistent attacks on working people and their unions across the spectrum. If people don't understand by now that anybody who speaks up against this president becomes a target, regardless of how protected you think you are, then you're unfortunately going to find out a big surprise as we move through this process.
Well, let me ask you about that, because, you know, the what I'm seeing, and maybe you've got information that I don't, from what I'm seeing, they've gotten rid of about 154,000 that were paying to not go to work because that's efficient. Right. And they're going to fire a bunch more. And the hiring process, because they don't want to use the civil service, the hiring process, as I understand it, is partially an essay quiz where you have to write an essay on your favorite Trump executive order.
Oh, Jesus. No way.
Yeah.
That's some sick and twisted stuff there. I mean, what I know is that when he used the fig leaf of national security to strip collective bargaining rights from over a million federal employees, that was the largest single act of union busting in this country's history. We think about PATCO as it was a seminal date in union busting in this country. That was like 15, 20,000 people. This is over a million people that lose their collective bargaining overnight.
Yeah.
And I think that any union person looking at what this president is doing has to understand that this is about power, this is about control, this is about intimidation, and this is about serving the interests of those folks we were talking about at the very beginning, the billionaires who were all there lined up right behind him when he got inaugurated. Not to mention this whole thing about AI and, you know, removing any ability for the tech people to have complete access to our data, to have complete unfettered ability to develop whatever products and spying activities they want. This morning, they're talking about announcing that now they're going to have access to all of our healthcare data because it's going to be more efficient if everybody can have access to everything. That's, I'm sure, going to end well. Look, the bottom line is this, it's not about Democrat versus Republican, Rick. It's really not, because Lord knows we've had our issues on both sides of that equation.
Sure.
It's about who's standing with workers and who's standing with the billionaires right now. And the lines are getting clearer and clearer and clearer. And people are just going to have to decide where you at, because there's going to be no hiding, because you're one of the good union people.
But you brought this up, you know, the voters are going to have to decide. I look at what Texas is doing right now around.
Yeah, exactly.
What deciding?
Okay. So here's the thing. We doing all right? Time wise, we good?
Yeah, go.
All right. So here's the thing. People don't even know what redistricting and gerrymandering is. We talk about it like, you know, everybody knows what it is. Where I go and talk to workers, people don't have a clue. But so I'm just going to give you a little really brief introduction here. And that is, every 10 years, we do a census. And at that census, we see how many people are in our state. And that determines how many congressional seats we have to represent us in Washington. Okay. And each district has to be equal in number. So in Texas, it's like 710,000 people per congressional district. We have 38 of them, all right? So the legislature is charged with drawing the maps. You know, so do people understand, like, how do you get to be in District 1 and somebody else is in District 2? It's because the legislature drew those maps and that's how they decided to do it. As computers have gotten much more sophisticated, they draw these maps in a way that they, in Texas, we already know who's gonna win in 37 out of the 38 congressional districts, because they draw them to either favor Democrats or Republicans. And in Texas, even though Texas, the last couple of elections have been about 55-45, Republicans have about 75 of the congressional seats. Okay, so that's what we did in 2021. That's the maps they drew. And those are supposed to last until we get new census data. Well, what happened here in Texas? What happened here in Texas is the president passed a bunch of stuff in D.C. that is unpopular. People don't like tax break for billionaires. People don't like stripping collective bargaining rights. People don't like terrorizing communities. But rather than face that accountability of the voters in 2026, Donald Trump called his friend Greg Abbott, and he said, Greg, I need 5 more Republican seats in Texas. And Greg Abbott, of course, being a Texan, said, Mr. President, nobody tells Texas what to do. Texas is going to run Texas. Right? That's what a Texas governor. Well, no, actually, that's not what he said. He said, yes, sir. Okay. Yes, sir. I'll do that, sir. And so
I thought you were going to say, he said, we'll get you 10.
No, well, we don't. It's not over yet. So what they are doing is, he has called a special session of the legislature for the purpose of drawing a new map that will increase the number of Republicans coming out of Texas by 5 congressional seats. And so instead of being 25 to 13, it'll be 30 to 8. Okay. And why? Because the president of the United States said that's what we need to do. And he said jump, and they said how high.
Yeah.
Let me tell you how dangerous that is. If we are going to, like, if we are going to completely rig our system to know who's going to win and who's going to lose based on who the president demands that you do, like, what does that say? So I'm going to tell you, we are fighting with everything we can to get in the way and make sure this doesn't happen. We're working with the Democrats to get them to fight in a way that they've never fought before. And not only that, but here's the thing, and this is, I'll shut up in a minute, but I am so sick and tired of folks on our side saying, oh, we're better people. We play by the rules. We would never do this. We would never do that. We're bringing a water pistol to a gunfight. And it's time that folks who are fighting for working class people start fighting as well. And what that means is if Donald Trump's going to call the governor of Texas and say, I want 5 more Republican seats, well, the governor of California better call his folks and say, well, we're going to get 10 more Democrats in California.
Yeah.
And the governor of New York better do the same thing. And so we're going to be fighting with everything we have to make this as ugly and contentious as possible so that people around the country understand what's at stake. And if you're in a place with a, you know, it's going to also come to Florida and Ohio and all this kind of, you know,
well, Ohio's not, already there, Rick.
He's not stopping in Texas. Okay. Nope. And so folks got to be ready to either say, look, we're going to do some things that we might not want to do, but we have to do this to, you know, because if he is allowed to rig these elections in 2026 and serve without any accountability on his presidency in 2026, then we are in for a world of hurt. And I'll tell you what it's going to be like, Rick Smith. When you see elections in Russia, right? And why is it in Russia that they say they have free elections? They go to the polls every year. And why does one team always win? It's because the system is set up where it can't be any other way. And their claims to free and fair elections are bull. And that's exactly where we are heading in this country. If we want to have real elections, and if we want to have communities have a real voice in what governs them, we better wake up to this intentional, racist, corrupt power grab and get about defending ourselves and fighting back.
I'm right there with you. I said, you know, back when they were going, when they go low, we go high, nonsense. When they go low, you smash their heads into the ground to make sure they don't do it again. That's what we should be doing. Rick, as always, great stuff. I appreciate the time. I hope you'll come back and keep us up to date on what's going on in Texas and organizing and fighting.
Yeah, you know, thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me. And I'll just say, you know, to those of your listeners that are in places like New York or New Jersey or California, please don't let your politicians look the other way at this. Make sure that you know what's at stake, Amen. That you get organized. We're going to be working with union members from all these different states to put together a program that's going to fight back, and hope folks will fight back with us.
Look forward to it. Rick, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Rick. Appreciate you, sir.
Rick Levy, president of the Texas AFL-CIO. Check out their website, texasaflcio.org. Want to hear your thoughts. You ready for the fight? You think Democrats, who I've often said, you know, in a street fight, will offer to hold your coat? Think they're up to it? Want to hear your thoughts. Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1942. That was the day that the United States and Mexico signed the Mexican Farm Labor Agreement. It became known as the Bracero Program. The word Bracero can be translated into one who works with his arms and refers to farm workers. This program allowed Mexican agricultural workers to enter the United States on a temporary basis. There was a shortage of labor due to the U.S. entry into World War II. Large American farm owners were clamoring for cheap labor. By 1945, more than 100,000 Mexican migrant workers were employed through Bracero contracts, mostly in western and southern states. Most were farm workers, but others labored on the railroad. The program continued until 1964. More than 4.5 million individual labor contracts with Mexican workers were awarded as part of this program. Many of these workers faced exploitation and discrimination. For example, some of the workers had to subject themselves to fumigation by DDT before they could enter the United States to work. These Mexican workers were often paid less than white workers performing the same labor, and they were often cheated out of their wages. The workers were required to work long hours under often grueling conditions. Despite this exploitation, the Bracero program did have some minimal protections for pay and working conditions for those under contract. Farm owners unwilling to meet even these low standards began to hire undocumented labor to skirt the rule. Labor organizer Ernesto Galarraza wrote a book about the program called Stranger in Our Fields. In it, he recounts a worker explaining, quote, "In this camp, we have no names. We are called only by numbers." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I got to tell you, I really like Rick Levy. I wish that we had more folks like that. And as we talked about, look, the reality is labor is the last hope for democracy in this country. People like Rick, his members, their affiliates, all of those, that's the last hope for democracy in this moment. And I said it was going to be at the beginning of this nightmare, that it was going to be labor unions who are going to be the last line of defense. Because they're used to standing up. They're used to organizing. They're used to fighting the boss. And if you're going to run a government like a corporation, you're fighting the boss. And right now, Trump and his ilk, they're moving in a direction to make conditions better for them and, well, not so good for their employees. Or, in this case, their citizens. And for me, I've been saying all along, it's going to take us organizing. It's going to take us coming together. Understand, Texas is kind of the petri dish where they're dreaming up the disease that's going to kill us, and they're going to revive company towns. The fact that Musk went there with the intention of we're gonna be able to control this area, we're gonna be able to control the workers, the citizens, we're gonna be able to control everything that happens. At some point, you know that this is going to spread. And as it spreads, who are going to be left behind? Well, it's those of us who work for a living. Do they start taking property through eminent domain because, well, we need to expand our big company town? And as we move to company script, digital currencies, here we go. And I've had some people who have emailed me, "Oh, you're just being hyperbolic." I wish I were. I wish I believed that there was benevolency behind all of this. I wish I believed that Elon Musk really does care about his factory workers and the people that make him his billions. I wish I believed that, but I don't, because they've shown us nothing. They've shown us nothing to give us any faith that any of that's true. What they've shown us is they believe more for them, less for you and me. That their rights come before yours often, always. And that, well, your needs aren't that important. And look at what they've done in red states across this country by limiting the ability of people to organize with their no rights at work legislation. By going after gatherings of people protesting in Florida, like I said the other day, you can literally run into a crowd with your car now. You think that's meant to make redress of grievance possible? Or do you think, like I do, it's a way of silencing the unwashed masses? We the people. You, me, us. Good on Rick and good on the people who are putting up a fight. You want to be part of that? I want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I want to know what you're doing, what groups you're working with, who you have faith in. I want to hear it, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM. W248DE Wisconsin Rapids. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Christopher Cruz. A majority of Texas House Democrats have left the state, denying the Republican-controlled legislature the chance to vote on a bill that redraws the state's congressional districts. Here's KRLD radio reporter Chris Fox.
Texas House Speaker Dustin Burrows with a few words for his Democratic colleagues who fled to Illinois and New York State to stop today's scheduled vote on the new map.
They've left the state, abandoned their posts, and turned their backs on the constituents they swore to represent.
Texas House Democrats call the redistricting racial gerrymandering. State Rep Donna Howard.
It is not about helping the people of the state. It's a pure power grab from President Trump.
Warrants have been issued for the Democrats' arrest. Governor Abbott has also threatened to remove them from office. Chris Fox for CBS News, Austin.
And tonight, California Democrats have a plan to flip Republican seats to Democratic seats. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi